Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, the latest UN climate conference opens. It's what they're calling the Money COP, with nations deciding how much richer nations should give poorer nations to help deal with climate change.
Globally, we need investment of at least $1 trillion a year. You know, this is not small beer trying to transform the global energy system.
We'll also find out how energy from Icelandic volcanoes could be a non-polluting and renewable source of power. Plus, the plight of Iranians in one of the world's biggest producers of oil now facing daily power cuts. And how workers in Valencia during the flooding had their lives put at risk by their employers.
That day, several companies didn't take any preventive measures and ignored weather alerts. That's a huge problem.
And you can contact us, of course, at all times on WhatsApp or send us a voice note. +44 330 678 3033. That's +44 330 678 3033. Now, the latest UN climate conference has been getting underway. The COP, the name stands for Conference of Parties, is number 29, and it's happening in the Azeri capital, Baku, just as projections suggest this year will be the hottest that the Earth has ever recorded. It also comes as the United States has elected Donald Trump, a climate skeptic, as its next president. Opening the event, this COP29 president-designate, Mukhtar Babayev, said the summit must end the suffering of people caused by climate change.
COP29 is a moment of truth for the Paris Agreement. It will test our commitment to the multilateral climate system. We must now demonstrate that we are prepared to meet the goals we have set ourselves. This is not easy.
Mukhtar Babayev, well, the BBC's climate and science reporter Esme Stallard is in Baku and joins me now. Esme, thanks for being with us. Well, first of all, this meeting is taking place, I guess, into the shadow of the US election. The president of the US from January is going to be a climate skeptic. How is that overshadowing things?
Well, it certainly is. I mean, last time Trump got elected, within a few years, he pulled the US out of the Paris Agreement. Now, a couple of hours ago, we heard from John Podesta, who is Biden and still president for a couple more months at least, from his special envoy on climate. And what he wanted to reiterate to people is, despite the fact that Trump was a climate denier, as he said, that the policies President Biden's put in place and also the action of states and cities across the US means that the emissions of that country will still continue to go down, albeit slowly. He said something quite stark, I think I just want to say to you, is that he said the fight is bigger than one election, one political cycle and one country. He was trying to make the point there that, yes, we might have Trump for 4 years, but there'll be further presidents who hopefully continue the action on climate change. And there are many other countries that are here in COP29 who are continuing action on this agenda.
Much for people to think about there, I guess, at the meeting. But the meeting, Esme, I've heard some call it the Money COP, the focus being on finance. In fact, we heard a little bit earlier from the BBC from Dr. Paulo Teru, who's the chair of the Association of Small Island States.
Everyone is expecting this COP to be the finance COP. This is an issue that is of critical importance. We do need the resources to mitigate and adapt to the adverse impact of climate change. It's really about our survival. It's very possible within the next 10, 20 years, some of these countries will disappear.
Well, that was Dr. Pau Lutero there, who's one of the delegates there at Baku. But Esme, the money he's talking about, the money they're all talking about, really, is an amount that has been given over the years, an agreed amount by richer nations to poorer nations. It's got a rather lengthy and slightly bizarre name, but it's going to be renewed next year in 2025. First of all, what is this amount of money? How does it work?
Yes, there's lots of discussion on the table. So listeners will probably remember that before there was this goal of $100 billion by 2020. That was eventually achieved 3 years late. That now needs to be updated. Now, the key things they're looking to discuss is three things, really. It's how much should that figure be? And that varies massively. We've seen some developing countries come forward with an estimate between $1 and $2 trillion. The other key thing is, how is that money going to come? So traditionally, a lot of that money has come in the form of loans. loans. Now, developing countries have complained that this just burdens them with more debt. They end up paying off the interest and not actually being able to repay the money, which actually makes them more unable to deal with climate change. And the third issue up for discussion is actually who is going to pay the money. So you mentioned there that previously it's been developed countries, but in fact there is a discussion going on whether that list should be updated, because there's only 23 countries in that group, and actually them being able to raise that $1 trillion could be very, very difficult. So what is being put on the table at the moment, what we've seen in the sort of proposal text, is that in fact that group could be expanded to include other countries that maybe have developed more significantly over the last 10, 20 years since that list was first made. So countries like South Korea, Singapore, Kuwait, UAE could get added to that list. So there's still a lot to be discussed.
Well, we'll see how it all comes through. Esme, thanks for being with us. Esme Stallard there on the line from Baku. So this money, known as the New Collective Quantified Goal, NCQG, has been taking billions, hundreds of billions so far. Trillions may have to be in prospect, but how has it been used up to now? How will a potentially much higher figure in the future, possibly coming from this COP, achieve more in helping poorer countries to support their climate actions? Well, Michael Grubb is Professor of Energy and Climate Change at University College London. He's an observer at the COP in Baku right now. And I asked him if the $100 billion a year given so far had actually been well spent.
The $100 billion was never really a project. It was a number. But generally, yes, it's gone to overall projects in the climate arena. As often, there's arguments about both how good those projects were, some of the side effects, as well as some countries feeling it went more to some countries than others.
And now we're going to talk about trillions rather than billions. You mentioned hundreds of billions there, but in fact, the argument this time for the next stage of all this is going to be much increased. What kind of figure would be realistic, do you think, at this stage?
Well, put it this way, the overall investment that we require to meet the Paris goals would put you in potentially a trillion a year or so. Now, I don't think anybody imagines that that can or even should be met primarily by developed country governments. That ain't going to happen. No way. So there's going to be a lot of debates over, first, what is the scope of the number that they're arguing about? Because it ain't going to jump from 100 billion to a trillion, but most people recognize globally we need investment of at least a trillion a year. You know, this is not small beer trying to transform the global energy system.
Should the onus then be on those who are creating the problem, i.e. we're talking about oil and gas companies? Now, you've done some research on how much money they have made. Is there not a logic to using that if it were possible, I guess, through taxes?
Short answer is yes. I think that governments need to be looking harder at the sheer amount of money that has been made by the companies ultimately that are profiting from the climate change problem getting worse, i.e. selling, marketing fossil fuels. They will always respond they're only selling the product that people want, but the fact is that they make incredible amounts of money from that. And our analysis said during the year of the energy crisis, they made overall over $1 trillion. And of that, $500 billion was supernormal profits, profits above those projected at the beginning of the year. It's also really worth noting that about $300 billion of that was made by the private companies, the vast majority of which headquartered in the OECD countries. The other $200 billion, though, or $210, was by state-owned companies. So things like Saudi Aramco and others.
And your point is that all this should be part of the discussions that we're hearing at COP about this amount and how it's raised and where it goes.
I think it should be. And I think that there's several reasons. Obviously, it's going to be politically difficult. We know that. But there's several reasons it should be. One is the basic moral argument that those companies profiting from the climate problem should contribute towards solving it. You don't want to underestimate the importance of that and the historical legacy involved. And there's lots of arguments about the economic principles there. But there is another aspect, which I think is not sufficiently taken account of, which is that by doing that, you start to make the fossil fuels less profitable and thereby accelerate the transition that we badly need. And it's a signal to those companies as well to say, look, you know what your products are doing. You know this cannot go on forever. You know you're going to have to diversify into clean sources. So you are going to see the economic signals align with that in terms of higher taxes on fossil fuel operations.
Professor Michael Grubb. Well, part of the push coming from the COP meetings is to use non-polluting sources of energy, and geothermal sources seem to offer part of the answer. In Iceland, a team of scientists are preparing to drill two boreholes into one of the world's most active volcanoes, Krafla. One borehole will create the world's first underground magma observatory. The idea is to get measurements that could help better predict how volcanoes behave and when eruptions might occur, to potentially save lives and economic losses. But the second is to tap into a source of energy so hot it could turbocharge geothermal power and be an almost limitless source of cheap, green electricity. Adrian Murray reports.
On the edge of a 10-kilometre-wide caldera, steam vents and mud pools bubble away. This is one of the world's most active volcanic hotspots, and at its centre is Krafla, a volcano that's erupted 30 times in the last 1,000 years. Bjorn Tor Gudmundsson, the CEO of KMT, the Krafla Magma Testbed Project, leads the way over a grassy hillside.
We are basically standing on the spot where we are going to drill.
It doesn't look like much just yet, but 2 kilometres beneath our feet is a red-hot magma chamber.
What we want to do is to revolutionise the way we monitor volcanoes.
And starting in 2026, they'll begin work on the first of 2 wells to create an underground magma observatory.
The plan is to place sensors in the magma, temperature and pressure sensors. This will allow us to predict with more accuracy volcanic activity. So this will change how we predict eruptions.
Volcanoes can be spectacular, but they're also devastating. And around the world, millions of people live close to them.
In the Eyjafjallajökull eruption at the time, the economic loss was estimated around 3 billion euros because of delays in flights and so on. If we would have been able to predict the eruption, that could have saved a lot of money.
Then with a second borehole, KMT wants to harness powerful energy called near-magma geothermal. Bjarni Pálsson is Executive Director of Geothermal Development at Iceland's national power provider, Landsvirkjun.
The plan is to drill just short of the magma itself, possibly poke it a little bit. But the geothermal resource, which is located just above the magma body, we believe that is around 500 to 600 degrees Celsius.
Scientists were drilling here in 2009 when they stumbled across this shallow pocket of extremely hot molten rock.
We were able to measure the power that comes out of it. This well produced about 10 times more than the average well in this location, giving us a very strong indication of the extremely powerful resource that we may be sitting on.
It sits close to a geothermal field where a power plant supplies hot water and electricity to about 30,000 homes. Just 2 of these super hot boreholes could supply the same energy as this entire plant.
We now today need to feed the power plant with 22 normal wells. So there is an obvious game changer.
But drilling will be technically challenging.
This is carbon steel, so the typical material used in the geothermal wells.
Inside a lab at the University of Iceland, Sigrun Nanna Karlsdottir is leading researchers, testing materials to withstand extreme heat, pressure and corrosive gases.
These carbon steel materials lose strength quite quickly after 200 degrees Celsius. So we have to explore new materials and more corrosion-resistant alloys.
There's also the issue of safety, which I put to the project's CEO.
All this sounds just a little bit risky. Is it going to be safe to do this?
We believe that sticking a needle into a huge magma chamber is not going to create an explosive effect. This happened in 2009 and they found out that they had probably done this a few times before without even knowing it. So we believe it's safe.
If all goes to plan, there's the possibility of tapping into cheap, clean energy that's potentially limitless. And the team think this could be replicated around the world. Here's Bjarni Pálsson again.
Possibly this kind of geothermal power production can be applied in many, many other locations around the world where we have active volcanoes.
So perhaps this far-out idea could have huge potential.
Adrian Murray reporting there from Iceland. With World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Let's have a look at how international share markets have been doing at the week begins, the week, of course, after the US election. I'm joined by Lindsay James, investment strategist at Quilter Investors in London. Lindsay, thanks for being with us. First of all, let's turn our focus towards China because it's Singles Day, which we've often reported here, very much seen as a push towards the retail market doing rather well on this particular day. Lots of discounts, lots of buying going on.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this is something that college students initially began, really to celebrate people who are single, and Alibaba jumped on it. They're, of course, a major retail platform in China. They began to push it as a big shopping event in 2009, and then since then it's really snowballed into what is one of the largest shopping days on the planet. So hundreds of billions of dollars of goods are sold on this particular day. Now, I think what was important to notice was that in 2022, they actually stopped reporting sales activity. And that's, of course, quite a clear signal that it wasn't going to be good news. So although it's still a major shopping event, I don't think we're going to see much of a recovery this year either. Now, there's a couple of reasons. I think consumers are getting more cynical about these sorts of events. And I think we'll see that as well in coming months with things like Black Friday too. Now, a lot of people recognise now that these platforms tend to hike prices ahead of the sales event and then only sort of drop them on the day. So that's one factor. But also in China, of course, we've got really weak consumer confidence there. It hasn't recovered since the pandemic. And I think that's really because of the exposure that a lot of consumers have got to the property market. That's going to be really slow to turn around. So this is, I think, going to be an issue for some time in China where we're just still seeing that weakness in retail.
Now, the other thing I wanted to mention to you was Bitcoin, because we've seen a huge surge in the price of Bitcoin post US elections. I said some people suggesting that the Trump administration would be rather more lenient towards cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin went over $82,000 at one point.
Well, yeah. So this is a huge turnaround, as you said. So Donald Trump used to call it a scam against the dollar. And it was recently a sort of 2021 is on record as saying that. But over the course of his campaign, he's really, really changed his tune. It's partly because, of course, his campaign was funded by people with interests in crypto. He's also started his own family business in this area too. And he said he wants to make the US the crypto capital of the planet. So that's been sort of a real tailwind for the asset. Yeah. We've also seen the SEC easing a little bit of regulation this year, bringing in more ETFs, which give financial institutions a route into the market. So that's been an ongoing tailwind. But the SEC chair, Gary Gensler, I think he's going to be heading for the exit under Donald Trump. He's vowed to fire him on day one. So I think that's going to remove this voice of caution from the sector.
Could turn things around. Thanks so much for being with us, Lindsay. Lindsay James there of Quilter Investors. Now, people in Iran are having to get used to their electricity being switched off for 2 hours a day. It's affecting the capital, Tehran, and, in fact, the whole country. The government says it's because of a need to reduce pollution. Now, it follows a decision to use only gas rather than oil to run power stations. Iran, which is subject to heavy Western sanctions, is thought to have the third highest reserves of crude oil in the world, after Venezuela and Saudi Arabia. Well, I'm joined by Behrang Tajin, who is the economics correspondent for the BBC Persian Service. Behrang, thanks for being with us. Just tell us what's actually happening at the moment. How is it working?
So from today, every home, both in urban and rural areas of Iran, will face a two-hour planned power cut during the day, sometime between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Iran's biggest city and capital, Tehran, has been divided into 24 areas, and people are supposed to get an SMS or a text message informing them the time of power cut for their home. But after so many people tried to log on the website of Tehran's provincial electricity company, it went down. But the two-hour daily blackout during the day is set to continue for now.
So I was just trying to mention there why it's happening, but you can explain much better. I mean, why are they not using oil to run power stations?
So there are a few reasons behind this blackout. In one word, the problem is shortage, or as the government officials put it, energy imbalance. Basically, Iran hasn't built enough power plants over the past two decades to keep up with the rapidly growing demand. The government set tariffs are also so low that there is very little incentive, financial incentives, for households to curb their consumption. The price could be as low as 0.04 cents per kilowatt hours. That's almost 1,000 times less than what you pay, say, in the UK. Then there is the decision to shut down just three power plants situated next to big cities that were using a type of heavy fuel oil called mazot, causing a lot of air pollution. The government says it made this decision to tackle air pollution in these cities, Tehran, Isfahan and Iraq, which is always a big problem, especially at this time of the year. But why were they using heavy fuel oil? Because of the shortage of natural gas. You know, apart from the domestic consumption for heating homes and businesses, natural gas in Iran is used to feed its huge, very profitable petrochemical industry. It's also used in oil extraction and heavy industries. So power plants are kind of at the back of the queue and have to use, especially during autumn and winter, you know, heavy fuel oil instead. In addition to all of these, the manufacturing and farming sectors in the previous years shouldered the burden of shortage of electricity in Iran. So they kind of complained and said, we can't have our electricity cut for 3 months a year and our gas for 3 months a year. We are going out of business. So they are hoping that the government kind of prioritizes them a bit.
Very, very difficult times for them, of course. Behrang, thanks so much for taking us through that. Behrang Tajin there, the economics correspondent for the BBC Persian Service. Now, the devastating floods in Spain's Valencia region last month killed over 200 people, and they've led to widespread anger over the way the authorities reacted and failed to react. But it's become clear now that some businesses were also slow to realise the dangers that they were putting their workers in. The BBC's Stefania Goza has been looking into the role companies could play to keep their employees safe during such natural disasters.
The 29th of October, the day flash floods swept through eastern Spain, many of the people who got caught on the roads were coming out of work and heading home. Weather warnings had been issued since the early morning, and by 8 a.m., the south of the province was on red alert, with the Spanish weather agency asking the public not to leave home unless strictly necessary. Yet companies like the one where Ahmed Sidi Benha works still expected staff to commute to their work centers.
We were never told not to go to work. We started the afternoon shifts as usual at 2 p.m. and by 5 p.m. we had to be evacuated to the factory's first floor. Half an hour later, the river had busted all around us. There was water everywhere. There was no salvation if you tried to get out. The first floor was the only safe space. Cars disappeared as if they were toys. With no electricity, no running water, no food, no signal. At least we had bottled water to drink, but we had to spend the night there.
Many aspects of the circumstances that led to the tragedy are being debated in Spain, and one of them is the role companies should play to prevent putting employees at risk during natural disasters like this one. Daniel Patiño is a spokesperson in Valencia of Spain's largest union, Comisiones Obreras.
Some companies have empathized with the tragedy, but others have prioritized profits over workers' safety. That day, several companies didn't take any preventive measures and ignored weather alerts. That's a huge problem.
What lessons can we take from this?
We've been saying for years that plans to adapt to climate change aren't being applied. We need to adapt cities, roads, firms, and work centers to climate change.
People have turned to social media to ask the government to ban economic activity when there are weather warnings. Is that necessary?
Our goal is to safeguard the public's health. Ideally, companies would make that decision themselves and enforce it strictly, but we've seen that doesn't work, so an independent authority should determine these additional measures when there's a red alert. We have the weather computer models, we have the information, we also have the communication channels. We need more strength and ambition. So if it's the government who has to decree the suspension of operations, then so be it.
The Spanish Minister of Work has said that she's going to ban the dismissal of staff who missed work because of the disaster and what has come after it. Why? Are people being fired?
We're seeing dismissals. The first have just come in.
And we're seeing that people living in houses and streets that haven't been cleaned yet are being forced to go to work because their work centres aren't damaged, or because they've been damaged and they're being summoned to contribute to the cleaning.
With the catastrophe hitting both employees and employers, tension at workplaces is on the rise, as we'll hear now from Fabián Leal, a Colombian electrician who lives in Alfafar, one of the worst hit areas.
I was living in the scene of a catastrophe, focused on solving local problems. I was on my way to help clean the church when my boss called me early on Monday morning. He asked why I wasn't at work. I reminded him that my neighbourhood was affected by the floods, that my car had been completely destroyed, and that there were no trains or underground. He said, with bad manners, "Find a way. You need to be here or face the consequences." That made me angry. But my wife had lost her job in a real estate agency because her boss closed the company after the floods. So I was angry, but also worried. I walked to my workplace. It took me almost 4 hours. When I got there, he said my shift started at 7, not at noon, so he didn't let me in. We had many fights, and my case was on TV, making him look bad. In a nutshell, he hasn't fired me, but not because he doesn't want to fire me, but because that could bring him trouble.
Fabian's manager told the BBC he did say to his employee that he should have found a way to reach work, but that it happened in the heat of an argument. He said he has also lost everything. His house is covered in mud, and all of his company's tools and vehicles have been destroyed. This manager says that if Fabián had called a day earlier to say that he wasn't going to be able to go to work, he would have understood. Fabián is back at work now, but as they both admit, there's an open wound that will hardly heal.
Stefania Goza reporting on the way in which some employees were treated during that terrible situation in Valencia. And in fact, there is some breaking news on that. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has announced another $4 billion worth of aid for the Valencia region. That's nearly 2 weeks after those deadly floods. And there has been, of course, a big outcry about how the authorities behaved. That's it from World Business Report. Bye-bye.